Street Smart Podcast coming today from the studios here at Upright Digital, the lounge. And we're talking to Taylor Golden. Fantastic name.
It doesn't suck.
It is an outstanding name. and Taylor was gracious enough to come on the show. And so thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
And so you and I got connected in kind of off LinkedIn, like most people that connect nowadays. And like you said, it was just sort of serendipitous timing, and some of the things were aligned in our, you know, geographic positioning. And so I asked if you wanted to be on the show. And so here you are. So yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So really what this is just a discussion about, you know, who you are, and you have a fascinating background. You started a tremendous amount of businesses, and you've done some things that from the outside looking in, someone like myself looks at and goes, man, I didn't even know that could be a thing. Or, you know, a lot of people use that as sort of like a side hustle, but you really kind of took it to the next level. And I want to get to all of that. And obviously there's a lot of information in that. But first, where are you from? Where were you born? Where were you raised? You know, that kind of stuff.
I'm from good old Humble, Texas. And you know, we don't pronounce the H in Humble.
Correct.
Yeah. That's how you know if it's an outsider.
Well, I was born in Midland. We have a street in Midland named Humble.
Mm-hmm.
And most everybody in Midland pronounces it Humble.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's not the way. That's not the way that's said at all.
Yeah.
So born in Humble, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And raised there too?
Yeah.
Move around or?
No, Wildcats. Graduated 02. Just there my whole life. As soon as I turned 18, though, I got out of town. I moved to St. Louis for about 12 years.
St. Louis, Missouri.
Missouri.
Yeah.
Or as I call it, Missouri.
Misery. But you were there for how many years?
12. Yeah.
And how early in that 12 years did you nickname it Misery?
Pretty early. I got hooked on it after about 4 years, though.
Okay.
It's a beautiful place to live. Rolling hills, you get all four seasons. It's really nice. And it's a much slower pace of life. Houston is a massive city, but St. Louis thinks it's a big city, but it's really a small town.
Yeah, sure. And what did you move there for?
I moved there for my ex-husband, and just kind of got stuck there. I started seven companies there, so just kind of planted roots there.
Well, so seven companies, and that's a lot to unpack. Did you, when you left here, was that always the plan? Like, I want to go into business for myself, or what did you want to be when you were a kid?
Oh, when I was a kid, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, so I've been a musician since I was five, so Amy Grant was my idol. I wanted to be Amy Grant since I was little, this like famous Christian singer.
And she's unbelievable.
She's like, incredible, yeah.
Yeah, she's very good.
Yeah. My mom actually just played all these old childhood videos, and it's me at all of these like talent shows singing Amy Grant songs.
You knew her whole catalog.
Yeah, I knew everything. Yeah,
yeah.
That was my girl. So I actually had a performing music scholarship in college, and I was going to be an opera singer. I've been classically trained since I was five. But I realized that I have stage fright. I hate being the center of attention.
No way.
I break out in hives. But if I'm with like 80 other people, I'm good. But you can't make money being in the chorus. So switched, had a short stint in elementary education as a major because I figured you get summers off. It's probably easy pay. It's not easy pay. I had to tutor first graders for 6 months. I'm like, get me out of here. There's no way I can do this.
Yeah, first graders are a unique bunch. My wife, for a period of time when we lived in Fort Worth, she would substitute.
Mm-hmm.
And the sweet spot for her was like fifth, sixth graders. Once she got it to, like, she had to do high school, it was misery. It was terrible. Below that was just the most interesting things would happen that mm-hmm. you were like, oh man, that's not something I want to deal with. But so tutoring first graders.
Yeah, I think you have to be a saint to work with children, especially in the educational system. It just was nothing what I expected. And I quickly switched to marketing. And that's when I discovered, like, this is what I'm supposed to do. I
sure.
absolutely love marketing.
So your degree is in education?
No, it's in marketing.
In marketing.
Yeah.
Oh, so as you were going to school is when you were tutoring first graders.
Right. So they make you tutor first graders if you decide to major in education, like elementary education. It's like
as a weeding out process,
exactly.
I would imagine.
I mean, it worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah. Yeah. Nope, not for me. I'm going to do something else.
Yeah.
And so then you switched to marketing. Was there like a specific part of marketing that you were more interested in than others, or just general?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Like at 18 years old, how are you supposed to figure out what you want to do for the rest of your life? I've always been an ideator, so just thinking of new ideas, and that kind of seemed to fall in line with marketing. So it's just where I kind of naturally landed, and it turned out to be exactly where I was supposed to end up.
And so your degree's in marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you finish your degree and you go to work in for somebody, or are you starting a business at this point?
So throughout college, I'm a very hard worker. I graduated high school in 3 years. I went right into college, and I didn't do that whole going off to college experience. I went to night classes. I took 21 hours of night classes at a time at my maximum, and then worked 3 jobs during the day. And that was so that I could be further along in my career than other people my age, which I am. And I wanted to come out as debt-free as possible, which I am now. I had very little student debt because I paid for it all myself while I was working all these jobs. But during school, I was like a part-time marketing assistant for a little company in St. Louis. And my partner at the time was dabbling in photography. And we decided to just start doing photos as a side hustle. And then we decided to try and go for it full time. Like, we really loved the creative experience and the thought of building a business that was our own and we could, you know, curate our lives exactly the way we wanted to. So we decided to move forward with that. But we almost went bankrupt in 2 years. Like, we knew nothing about running a photography business.
Sure.
And until we realized that we should just apply our business skills that we went to school for. So we started applying our marketing and business degrees that we had just achieved, and grew it to a $1 million studio within 3 years.
That's amazing. So what were the things that, as you look back now, and I'm sure you've done this sort of, you know, dissecting that time, right? And you said, you know, we almost went bankrupt, and you know, what were some things that you didn't quite anticipate when you're like, man, we're going to take pictures, it's going to be great, and we're good at it, and then you're like, how is this not working out?
Yeah. The taking pictures is the fun and easy part.
Sure.
Unfortunately, that's not where business ends. You know, most of the business happens behind the scenes and everything surrounding that moment that you're capturing. So for every 1,000 pictures you take, that takes so many hours of time to edit, to back up the photos, to catalog everything. Then you have customer service, you have billing, you have emails, calendaring, marketing, sales. Like, how are you selling these pictures to these clients? You took them, now what? So
right.
You just kind of figure all of that out as you go. But I guess that's entrepreneurs in general. Like, we just do. We're doers.
Yeah, absolutely. So what now? So you start that studio, and how long after you started it did you realize, hey, we've got to figure out this business thing? Did it happen relatively quickly, or were you able to have enough runway where you thought, man, we have this figured out, and then all of a sudden it just sort of snuck up on you?
There was some educational like videos that we tried watching, but surprisingly there's not a whole lot of business education for artists, which is kind of funny because artists are not business people. So it's a big need, and that's actually an area that I ended up teaching to photographers, was business marketing, like sales, all of this. But there was one course that I remember watching where they talked about bringing your sales in-house. Like, it's easy for photographers, because we're artists and typically introverts, to just post your pictures online, pick what you want, and that equals like $80 of sales typically. And so that's one
like
educator.
Per unit is $80? Or
per session, so per client, which is nothing. Like, you can't make a living off of that. And so there was this one educator that said, bring them in-house, like have a sales session in person and help them pick out what they want. So we decided to try it once, and our first sale was $1,500.
Oh, wow.
Like, bingo.
That makes sense now.
Everyone comes in-house now. And so we started applying just basic business pricing principles. Like, all right, let's look at the different pricing structures that resonate in our lives. If you go buy a car, they have a package service, that package A, B, or C upgrade, and you get all these different features. You go to order McDonald's, there's packages, right?
Right.
We are trained to group things in packages because it solves multiple problems while giving a discount. So we did the same thing for our pricing. We had packages starting at $1,000, going up from there, including different things to meet different needs, and it worked. That was it.
That's awesome. And so you managed to figure that out and begin growing the business. And you said you grew it to a $1 million studio.
That's right.
How long did it take you to do that?
That took about 4 years, I think.
And the pictures you're taking, are they primarily like you're capturing people at an event? Or are you taking pictures of interesting looking things and selling them?
It's weddings and portraits.
Weddings and portraits.
Yeah, not so glamorous, though. It did lead to some pretty cool events. I got to photograph the President of the United States, the First Lady, several sports celebrities.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty fun.
How do you
fun.
Get that? Like, how does that even happen?
It's all through connections. Like, one of my portrait clients was the Senator of Missouri's son. Mm. And so they hosted this private fundraiser for Obama when he was re-campaigning. And it was at their house, which we'd photographed tons of times. And it's like 40
people. At the senator's house.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like a 40-person dinner, $15,000 a plate. And yeah. And it was a crazy experience. Like, they had these bomb-sniffing dogs that would check every piece of gear. And then we had to wear these special pins so that Secret Service knew we could be close to the president. They blacked out all the windows of the house, moved the neighbors out into a hotel. Like, it was a whole production. And then Obama comes in for 5 minutes and gives this speech. And he's so charismatic. Like, he hooks you right there.
Sure.
And I'm just like, yeah, no, this makes sense. I'm like, wait, I didn't vote for you.
Yeah. Yeah, like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, no.
I'm getting tricked, I think.
Yeah, brainwash. Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah, and I ended up posting some of the photos on my website, like, that night. And I got a call from the White House to take them down immediately because those were private donors that can't necessarily be associated with politics. Yeah, so it's like privacy protection. Like, oh crap.
What an amazing experience.
Yeah,
I mean, and did you actually get to meet them and spend any time, like,
no.
Hello or anything?
It was, oh,
just,
no,
you're just photographing an event they were at.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, he's like this close.
Sure.
To me, like, but yeah, I mean, he was there for 5 minutes, just in and out, and he's off to the next campaign stop probably.
Outstanding. So would you say that's the what would you say the coolest thing you've been able to photograph would be?
I've been to 22 different countries teaching photographers and shooting, but one of the most memorable moments was this bride who hired me, and they had to move the wedding date up 6 months because her dad was dying of cancer. Mm. And she wanted him to be there. I always cry when I talk about this one. And so the dad was bedridden, and he can't get out of bed. So they're having the wedding ceremony in their sunroom, where his room is set up, and he can't talk, he can't do anything. And she's in this gown, and it's like this house, you know, it's not the beautiful wedding that they planned. And the dad couldn't say or do anything much, but he took his daughter's hand and he put it on his future son-in-law's hands, and he brought them together. And it was, I'm like sobbing behind my camera, like the back of my camera is soaked with tears. It was so beautiful. And then the next day he passed away.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I don't know that you could ever top that.
No,
you know,
just
that, in terms of moment. Mm-hmm. I don't know that you ever get a moment better than that.
Yeah. Like, what a gift to be able to witness something so beautiful. And
well,
so
and
special.
Also to provide that memory to, mm-hmm. To her and their family, I'm sure is just immeasurable.
Yeah.
For them. Is that one of the things that really drew you to photography, is that you're capturing these moments in time that people can look back on and just say, wow, I mean, that was a great day, or that was a great time?
Well, I've always been an artist in some form, primarily in music, but I've always been good at photography. It's not necessarily my passion, but I love doing it. It's fun. But what really drew me to it was being able to show someone how beautiful they are, and when they didn't know that before. So a lot of my clients were like high school seniors, like awkward, you know, the kind of
yeah,
weird
worried
phase.
About starting life. Here we
yes.
go.
Yes, you know. Yeah, not comfortable in front of a camera. And one of the best compliments I received was when someone came to look at their pictures for their sales session. They were just jaw to the floor, and they said, I didn't know I was that beautiful. Like, that's my goal.
That's awesome. And so your passion, though, you would say, is music.
Yeah.
Have mm-hmm. you been able to, any of the businesses that you managed to found and move forward with or anything, did you ever manage to incorporate music in any of those?
No. And I'm okay with that. Like, that's strictly a passion of mine. So I get to do music for fun. I'm mm-hmm. happy that I didn't end up making a career out of it, because that would have probably taken a lot of the joy from it for me. So right now, the past couple of years, I've been a first soprano in the Houston Symphony, and that's just for me. Like, that's a purely a creative outlet that I get to have.
That's awesome. So you found the studio. What was the name of it?
Salvatore Sincotta Photography, which was my partner's name.
Okay. And that, how long was that in business?
I mean, it's still in business now. I ended up selling my share to Sal along with some other companies that we founded. But yeah, won 17 international awards myself. It's still hugely successful.
That's awesome. So you found that it's still in business, mm-hmm. and you said you founded other businesses with your partner at the time. So, you know, what were they? What was next?
Yeah.
You said, man, we've got this figured out. Let's try something else.
Well, what happened whenever we crossed that $1 million mark? Most photographers don't get there. Like, it's, people struggle because they're not business people, and so other photographers started coming to us to learn, how do I do that? Mm-hmm. And so we started helping people, but it grew to be so many people that were like, we need to start an educational business. And that's what we did. So we just started teaching photographers, and we actually did a 90-city tour across the United States.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was fun and a lot of work. I have a lot of gray hair because of that. But teaching photographers all over the country just how to make a living doing what you love to do.
Yeah, and you're not teaching them like photography techniques. You're teaching business, like, this is how you run a photography business.
Yeah, primarily. Of course, people want to learn the fun stuff too, so we would have that as an add-on if people really want to learn our type of technique for shooting. But primarily it was about business. And then that grew so much that we decided to start a photography magazine. So that was one of the businesses I started. It's the world's largest professional photography magazine. You can buy it in Barnes & Noble. And I was the VP of sales and marketing for that at like 27 years old. Had no.
But you were also a founder.
Yeah. Created it, founded it, VP, 27 years old. No idea what I was doing. Like, I'd never done ad sales. And here I am sitting with the president of Fuji and Nikon and Panasonic saying, all right, let me put this together.
It's going to be amazing.
Exactly. And I got a package for you.
Yeah. So I got a deal for you.
Exactly. The same kind of package structure. It's really like solution-based selling. That's what I was doing.
That's outstanding. And that's something that you took from when you kind of discovered that secret sauce with your original photography business. Mm-hmm. Have we packaged these things? You're able to add things, take things away sort of ad hoc so that you can almost tailor a solution, right?
Yeah, the point is to meet someone's need, but also to get them to the price point that you need in order to run a profitable business and make a decent living. And so it accomplishes both. Like, my goal would never be to sell someone that something they don't need, right? Because I'm very like just mission and values based. That's not a part of who I am. So if someone was trying to buy a $4,000 piece of artwork and a photo is going to look terrible on it, I wouldn't sell it to him. I would tell them. But that creates a lot of trust in that relationship. So you act more as a trusted advisor and helping people, which is what resonates with me.
That's great. So you decided to start a magazine, and I'm going to assume that you had no background in publishing or any of that stuff. How do you even get started how did you get started? Where'd you even start? I mean, so I just asked that same, I said start a whole bunch just then. And what I mean is, where'd you start? Like, how did you get started doing that?
Yeah. Well, I had written for other magazines before, and because I had been an educator in the industry, I knew all the other writers. And so just started pulling together all of my friends and other photographers, other educators, collected them so that we had content, and then working with my sponsors that I had already. So I was sponsored by different camera companies from, and they would fly me to China, to Brazil to teach business again. And so worked with my sponsors, with all these other companies that I knew of, and you just start doing. Like, found a graphic designer, like, let's try it out. The first iteration of it was ugly, right? I would never put that out today. And started digital. And then eventually, once we had enough backing, we took it to print, which most magazines go the opposite route. They start print and go digital. And it's, as an entrepreneur, you're basically solving needs. Like, you find a gap and you create the solution for that gap. So we found a gap in the type of education being published for photographers and not having a multimedia experience in that education. And we created the solution.
And so that's what that magazine was offering. What was the objective of the magazine? Like, the target audience would be photographers that
Correct.
Had their own businesses.
Right.
And then the magazine sought to teach them the Everything. Skills for that, or
Everything. Business, a lot of creative skills. People mm-hmm. want to learn new lighting techniques, sales techniques. One of the cool features that we had was at the end of every article, there's like a QR code that you could scan and it would have additional videos related to that article from the writer. So you want to see this in action? You want to see this new technique? Here's a session of me doing it. So it was really a multimedia experience.
And so then those writers all were probably just contributors. They didn't work for the magazine, right?
Correct.
And so that helped them too to build their following.
Yeah, absolutely.
So of course they would want to write for
them. Yeah, it's a win-win.
And so you start that magazine when?
That was, when was that? 2011 maybe?
And how long did it take to grow? Because it became the largest of its kind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere?
Anywhere, worldwide.
So how long did that take?
Not long. Maybe 3 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's just, is that all organic? That
all organic, yeah. I've never had investors in any of my companies. It's all self-funded, self-created. There was one company where I did have a business partner and I kind of acquired his company, but that was it.
So what was that one?
That one was a post-production company.
Okay.
So if you're taking pictures, you're a photographer, my part of my message when I taught was outsource what doesn't make you money. Your money needs to be in front of clients, doing sales, doing actual shooting, not editing pictures, not culling, not color correcting. Those are all things that are essential to making a sale, but doesn't actually make you money. So that's what the post-production company did. And it's still operational today. So photographers would upload their images. We would train our editors how to edit to their style and then edit their pictures, send them back. And now the photographer gets their life back. They're not just chained to their computer.
So that, I can appreciate that. Mm-hmm. When I started the podcast, I did it all myself. Mm-hmm. I would go set the equipment up. I would tear the equipment down. I would bring the raw audio and video back. I would do all of the post stuff and everything. And I got to a point where I could sort of, it was like plug and play and somewhat, you know, just a process you work through. I'm not going to lie. It was pretty nice after we joined the network to be able to come in, sit down. All of my focus is on the interview,
right,
and then get done and leave it in Lauren's hands. She's amazing at it.
Yeah.
And that was one of my other questions I was going to ask is, obviously, as an artist, photographer, everyone has a unique style.
Mm-hmm.
And they have if you're sitting down to call a group of pictures that you've taken, you're going to see some that you're like, that's not what I want. And to the untrained eye, I'd be like, that's an amazing picture.
Yeah.
And so you say you train the post-production contractors, so to speak, to operate in that person's style. How'd you do that? Like, how are you able to, that's such a personal thing. How are you able to get that accomplished?
There was a learning sessions that would have to be conducted both ways, with the editor meeting the photographer, looking through their work, making notes, because God forbid something happens to the editor, that photographer still needs to be able to use those services and continue on. So it might be two or three editors that have to learn that same style, but they're also editing for 20 other photographers that have their own unique style. And so these are all just systems and processes that we had to figure out and put in place that made it scalable for the business too.
And so did those processes exist like in some other business model that you could borrow from, or did you have to figure those out on the fly?
Yeah, no, those were on the fly.
So how did you do that? Like, I mean, what you're describing is truly amazing. You're saying, one of the things you said that I really liked was, whatever doesn't make you money, outsource that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great technique, especially if you have a lot of things like post-production, there's a lot involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you were evaluating that process and nothing existed, where did you turn to say, okay, this is what we need to do versus something else?
As far as creating that company?
Creating the process behind that company.
So there were companies that already existed that provided those services, and we acquired one of them. So that's my business partner that I mentioned.
Right.
But the way they were doing things, there wasn't a great process or efficiency. And so bringing those business skills I think entrepreneurs are probably very efficient minded because your time is a very finite resource and it's your most precious resource. So protecting that and scalability, like we had to be able to turn things around quicker. I think back then they were looking at a 4-week turnaround. We needed to be like 1 week for our clients, for photographers, like time is money. And so finding different technology solutions like FTP sites, getting faster internet, finding remote workers instead of having everyone in-house, different things like that.
So, you know, leveraging technology is something that I've always worked to do because it can really be a force multiplier. Mm-hmm. And so the technologies that you identified, were any of them, you know, house built? Did you have to build any or tailor any to, you know, do what you were doing, or were they all pretty much out of the box, good to go?
Yeah, they were pretty much out of the box. What we did build was our form process through the site of how clients would submit jobs and how it would go into our queue, that sort of thing, but nothing incredibly robust.
Sure. So you acquire that business. So that's not one that you founded, but mm-hmm. obviously you're running that business, right? Mm-hmm. And how many businesses were you up to now?
Well, I sold 7 of them to my ex. We went through a divorce and I wanted a major life change. So I sold my half to him and decided to prioritize my family and own personal pursuits ahead of that. So now I'm down to 2.
And those 2 are what?
So Stay Golden, my last name, you know. Golden.
Again,
you gotta, you gotta,
amazing.
You have to find Stay Golden.
I was telling Lauren before, that's your maiden name, Golden?
Mm-hmm, it is.
I said, you know, I would change my name. Like that name is so.
I love that you would do that.
That name
talk
is
to my
so,
fiance, please.
That name is so amazingly marketable.
Yes.
That I would. I get it. Whatever. We'll go that route.
But. Yeah, my fiance knows that I'm not losing Golden. I might add his name, but. It is my brand, like literally my brand. So right. I have Taylor Golden LLC. That's just my own like photography or side, whatever that I feel like doing. Stay Golden, I published a book last year.
And what's the name of that book?
You're smiling because you know
I do know the name of the book.
It's called How to Get the D.
Right.
A Girl's Guide to Getting Divorced.
Oh, that's the D.
That's the D. It's a different
got
D.
I got you. All right.
A little play on words there.
That is so funny. That is a strong, strong title.
Yeah, thank you.
My wife and I were kind of doing some research this morning, and she was like, oh, she wrote a book. And I was like, yeah, check that out. And she was like, oh.
Oh,
she goes, oh, it's divorce.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. That's a fantastic name. So,
thank you.
So you wrote a book.
I did.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I was finding that whenever friends and family's relationships were going south, they would start coming to me almost like a consultant of how do I get through this time? Like, how do I interview an attorney? Where do I find an attorney? What questions do I ask them? How do I run my finances? And I realized that there were tons of resources on how to save your marriage, which that's ideal scenario. But unfortunately, once it gets past that point of no return, there was no guidebook to help people figure out how to navigate one of the most difficult moments of your life.
A terrible moment. No one enters into a marriage thinking, man, I can't wait for the divorce.
Yeah,
that's not how you do that.
No, it's. I mean, psychologists say it's harder than losing a loved one, like because there is with death, and I don't mean to minimize the loss of anyone, but with death, there is closure because that person is gone. But with divorce, that person isn't gone. You don't get that kind of closure.
Yeah. Also with death, you'd know that's coming your entire life.
Right.
Like you really, like that's the end for all of us at some point. And like I said, you don't enter into a marriage thinking, well, I can't wait for a divorce.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you identified again, very entrepreneurial.
A need. Yeah.
There's a need here. And again, very entrepreneurial. Rather than saying, let's continue looking to see if there's a solution out there, you said, I'll just build one.
Yeah.
How well was that received?
I don't know that I've made any money on it. I was hoping that it would get picked up by a publisher and that I would be able to pursue being an author more. Eventually, I wanted to write motivational books, self-help books. I love self-help books. But it hasn't gotten picked up. But after I wrote it, I just felt very done with it.
Mm-hmm.
I had all these ideas of how I was going to turn it into a business model and then a clothing apparel line that donated to charity, like all these things, right? Speaking circuits, all of that. But I just felt after I got done writing it, it was very therapeutic and I didn't expect that. But it's just like, I have this crazy story. It's like I've lived three different lifetimes, and just getting it all out there, it felt great. So I don't know that it's going to go anywhere, but I still have Stay Golden in case it does.
Right. So we won't harp on the book until it gets picked up by a publisher. Yeah. And that's fine. And I'll probably buy a copy.
I mean, you should.
I don't know where you can buy it.
I mean, I don't think you should, but
where can you buy it?
Just on Amazon.
I should have already bought one.
Yeah.
I'm going to autograph it today.
Yeah, you should have it here. Right here.
Sorry. The title kind of... I couldn't bring myself to put that in the cart. I was scared one of my friends would see it. And they would not have been as kind as like, oh, yeah, sure, it means divorce.
Oh,
it'd
been,
be it'd
so
been terrible.
Great. Yeah.
Absolute junior high kids, all of us. But so you have Stay Golden.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, you know, like motivational type. What exactly are you seeking to solve with Stay Golden?
Just change the world. I mean, just a little task. Eventually,
so
I...
So just that, huh?
Just that. No, not big deal.
No biggie. Maybe just the world.
I would love to eventually create a curriculum in public schools that teaches children character building skills. Because right now, because of divorce, most children grow up in a single parent household. And if you've been any kind of product of that environment, you realize how scarce your parents' time is. And they're just struggling to put food on the table and run errands, let alone try and instill these much needed character traits in children. And so the schools aren't teaching it. Where are they learning this from? Where are they looking to figure out this is the type of person that I should be? They're looking to social media. and
we all know that that's the best source.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
For all of that.
Yeah. I mean, look at the world that it's creating. These children have no coping skills. They have no conflict resolution skills. You can't have an intelligent debate with differing opinions and then not become emotional. Like, these are all things that we should learn as how to be a good human being. And so that's the kind of curriculum that I would love to see instituted into public schools all the way from kindergarten through college, really. Like, we're learning about parallelograms, but not how to do our taxes.
Sure.
How to find the right kind of partner. Like, the most important decision in your life, who teaches you what makes a good partner?
One of the most alarming things I heard recently is that there is a person selling courses to teens and early 20-year-old people on how to talk on the phone.
Wow.
To one another, like verbally communicate on a phone. And I thought, why? And because they don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They, like, my daughters, I have two daughters, one's almost 21, the other is almost 17, and they do a lot of FaceTime. I would say that's good. They're talking and they're still doing that, but man, if they ever get a phone call, they answer it, they're like, hello, and I'm like, hey, answer it with some gusto or something, right? At least act like you're somewhat alive. And so I do think that's missing.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, the divorce rate is extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of very compelling statistics to suggest that it's a challenge that needs to be addressed. So how are you doing that with Stay Golden?
I'm not yet.
Okay.
That's the ultimate goal, to get there someday. I very much believe that things happen in the time that they're supposed to happen. Like, I might have a lot of ideas because I'm an ideator, but that doesn't mean that I'm supposed to act on them right now.
Sure.
Like, whenever I wrote my book, I felt that this was the time that I needed to write it. But now I feel like it's not the time for it to take off. But that time could be in the future. It might not be in the future. But things seem to align themselves when things are supposed to happen. So there's a lot of synchrony happening in my life with my day job, and things are going great there. And then my engagement and just different things that have kind of been stirring inside of me. Now it's time. So I try to stay very in tune, like spiritually, mentally, emotionally, to understand when these cues are happening.
And what I guess that's more of a gut response, right? You're just kind of like, it feels like things are moving in the direction that this is something I can dedicate some time to. Mm-hmm. And so now you actually work for somebody. You don't, do you still have any Stay Golden, obviously, but any other business, your photography, anything like that? Do you have any other businesses that you're currently running?
I started a business last night, actually.
Well, did you do it just for this?
No.
Because that
no,
seems
I
a little
it. I mean,
cliche,
that is serendipitous
frankly.
Timing, but no, I didn't start it for this.
What is it?
So it is also something that has been stirring. I met with a girlfriend of mine 2 years ago. She brought me in because of my entrepreneurial background as for help with this idea of creating kind of like a home concierge service, to where It takes care of all of your regular maintenance needs, lawn, pool, cleaning the gutters, changing air filters, all these things as a homeowner that take up time and you have to sometimes rely on many different contractors to get the stuff done. So this would be just kind of an all-in-one service.
Or just me at my house.
Or just you, yeah. But there's also trends showing that men are not trained to do these types of things anymore. Like,
are you kidding
me? We're in our phone. They don't know how to do a lot of these things, or the homeowners are so young and no one's taught them. But there's also this huge aging population of senior citizens that need some type of solution so that they can just enjoy their life and still live independently. So there's a need. There's a need. Let's create a solution. Need. So it got some of my contacts together, and we're getting it started.
That's great. Do you have a name yet?
We're debating on the name right now.
Okay. Well, yeah. TBD.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing that you did that just for this show and start a business.
You're welcome. No, all your guests don't do that?
No. So you're A1 guest at this point. You also have some pretty amazing, like, hey, almost died in a hurricane parts to your life. I mean, when you say you've lived like three different lives, just reading some, you know, some cursory material preparing for this, it was pretty unbelievable. But so what, when you look back on all of the time you spent founding businesses and those types of things, at what point did you say, hey, I'm an entrepreneur, this is what I'm doing now, and so yeah, this is just what I'm going to be, I'm going to keep doing this, I understand it. And at what point did you realize, oh man, I am successful at this?
As an entrepreneur, I think you often feel like you're faking it, like, because we don't know what we're doing. We're just figuring it out as we go along. But there was one time when my company, we made the Inc. 5000 list. And that was such a validating moment, because we had felt like we were faking it. But that kind of felt like a legitimization. Like, you are a real business now. And we're like, oh, we're all grown up. Like, we actually did this.
Right.
And then we made the list 3 years in a row. And then we crossed into the millions, and we were surpassing our income that we ever could have imagined in corporate America, and buying multiple properties and starting more companies, and had 30 employees. Like, it all just kind of happens, and it's not instantaneous, but it's the slow just churn.
Was there ever a moment of like, man, I thought yesterday I had this figured out and now I don't? Like, is there just
every day,
every single day,
every day
you're like, oh, I'm completely lost here.
Yeah.
What do you think motivates you? So one of the reasons I started this, I watched my dad own businesses my whole life, so I understand that process. I have a lot of ideas myself, but I'm somewhat, you know, risk averse in that I'm like, yeah, I'm having pretty good money already doing what I do, and I don't really want to jump out and do something else. How were you able to say, you know what, I'm doing this, I'm just going to go out and do this? And I mean, the first business you founded was successful, so that's helpful.
Yeah.
Has that always been the pattern for you, that it's just, man, I started a business, is successful? Or were there some times along the way where you were like, I shouldn't have done that. This is not what we should be doing. I need to get into something else.
Yeah, I would say probably a little bit of both. I mean, most of my ventures have been successful, but like Stay Golden, the book, that I would say that wasn't successful. I mean, it was a success that I finished it. Like, it's an accomplishment to publish a book, but didn't achieve my goal. I don't know. I've had businesses fail in the back in the past, where I relied on other people. So I'm very leery about bringing on business partners, because I know myself, and I usually end up doing the majority of the work and the burden falls on my shoulders, but I'm also a worker. Like, I'm not just gonna sit back. If I know how to do something and I have the ability to do it, I'm going to do it. I don't know, the businesses that I've started have also played on each other. So they were all in the photography industry. So when you keep seeing another need, and it's very easy to branch out from what you're currently doing and then add on this other company or other service that is fed from your other businesses, like, that's kind of a no-brainer. You have the same market, and now you have a built-in referral system from your other businesses. But this new company that we're starting I've never had experience in it. Like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I do know sales. I do know marketing. I do know branding. I do know customer service. I do know process efficiencies. And so the business partners that we brought in, we each bring strengths to the table, and we have to learn how to live in our swim lanes. Like, we each have to come to the table with our own responsibilities and be accountable to one another. And it's only going to be through us fully showing up to each other that it'll be successful. So that's the risk. And that is probably the scariest risk for me, is relying on other people instead of myself. But I also know that that's probably going to bring more reward than I can ever find on my own either.
How are you, so obviously that's a potential sticking point.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get beyond that and say, no, this is, I need to do this?
It's that gut instinct. Like I told you, I've got tons of ideas. I can start up a new business every single day of the week if I wanted to. But because I've worked so hard in the past, I used to work 90 hours a week for 6 years. I mean, I had no life, no time with my family. I don't ever want to go back to that. And so I've been waiting probably for about 2 years now for this moment, this serendipitous moment where all the stars kind of align to find the right opportunity for me right now. Because whatever I invest my time in, I want it to have the maximum return. I'm not looking to make 20 grand on the side on the weekends and work all this extra time. Like, I'm looking to build a legacy. I'm looking to build a company that will be bought and that will set me up to start the next company.
That makes sense. And so one of the things you said there, you know, you're working 90 hours a week. There's no time. All of my time is tied up doing this. And it really becomes you. Like, it's who you are. It's what mm-hmm. you're doing. And I've watched other friends of mine that have owned businesses, started businesses, and they work themselves, they grind themselves into a powder for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my own tendency would be to do the same, which is one of the parts that makes me very reluctant. And is that something that you've noticed in your own life that has caused conflict? Or is that something that you were able to manage outside of creating conflict? Or is that something that you would say, hey, young entrepreneur out there, here's a cautionary tale. Don't tie everything in your life up mm-hmm. doing that.
Yeah, I would definitely caution entrepreneurs, because life will pass you by. I'm still relatively young, but I lost all of my 20s to work. Like, while other people were traveling and having fun, I might have traveled to a lot of different countries, but I never had a day to myself. I was teaching, I was working, and then moving to the next location. And so I think a lot of people, if they're not an entrepreneur, it looks very glamorous to be an entrepreneur, but very few people have the stomach for it mm-hmm. and are willing to make those sacrifices. But I think you have to keep your priorities in front of you at all times. Like, I lost sight of my priorities. And now my family is number one priority. My work-life balance and my inner peace are my priority, and I'm not willing to lose any of those things. So if it means taking things slower, like, maybe it'll take me 6 months to launch this business instead of 1 month. That's fine, because now my foundation will be stronger and I'll be better capable to manage the success whenever I do find it.
Is that something that you just resolve to do? Or because the 90-hour work week person is still in you.
Yes. Like,
that's just the core of who you are. So how do you, when you're going through the process of, you know, getting things off the ground, especially starting a new business, there are going to be times where you're like, if I just spend another 2 hours on this, mm-hmm. then I would get there. How do you sort of guard yourself against becoming that again?
Mm-hmm. So whenever I was working 90 hours a week, I suffered the consequences, not only my relationships, but I became physically ill. Like, my mm-hmm. doctors told me I had to stop working so much, or like, I could die. I mean, I went into premenopause at 28 years old. Like, it's insane.
I'm not a woman, but that sounds terrible.
It was terrible. It was terrible for everyone around me, too.
Yeah,
I can
well.
Tell you that. And so I know the consequences of it, so I stay far away from it for that reason. But I think establishing healthy routines and practices, I'm very much a routine person. So I wake up at 5:30, read for an hour, journal, get everything out of my brain onto paper, and then I go work out, and then I make breakfast and my coffee, and then I get to work. And so I think if you can maintain the healthy lifestyle that you've established, first of all, establish a healthy lifestyle and then follow the routine, that should help keep you in balance. But you also have to have those like North Star kind of people that speak into your life, that you give permission to speak into your life. So there's probably three people that I allow to call me out, and they have full permission to say anything they want to me. If they see me acting out of line or not being true to my character, I listen to those people. And so you gotta have to keep those people close to you.
It takes a lot to listen to people when they call you out. Yeah. Even if they, 'cause I have people in my life that have permission and some that don't, mm-hmm. that are more than happy to call me out. And they're always right. Mm-hmm. They're always able to see where I'm sort of off track. And I rarely receive that well in the moment. But I can reflect on it and get there. And I think routine is important also. Back when, you know, in 2020, everybody's getting to work from home. And so I still work from home. Mm-hmm. And when I was setting up my home office, I was like, I'm going to set my office up in the media room upstairs. And my wife was like, well, you know, we have an actual office downstairs. I was like, yeah, but all of you are down here.
Yeah.
And for me, it was very, to your point, because my tendency is if all of my work stuff's at home, I'll just do this until I'm done for the day. And that might be at midnight. Mm-hmm. Or the way I looked at it is I get up in the morning. For me, it's, you know, go to jiu-jitsu or whatever, come home and shower, make coffee. And then I actually physically go somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I have to physically go upstairs to go to my office. And somehow in my mind says, okay, you're going to work. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm done, I leave that and I go downstairs. I can leave work, so to speak. And there are times that I have to go up and take care of something quickly. But I do think it's important to establish those routines to sort of guard against your own tendencies. Mm-hmm. Have you found yourself able to really stick to that? Or, like, I promise there, for me, I know there is, so I'm assuming for you as well, there are times that you're like, if I just spend a little bit more time, is that when those people come into play and like, hey, why don't you put the phone down and come hang out with us?
So whenever I start getting out of balance, it becomes more of a shift in my attitude. Mm. Like I can be more militant and just very task focused and lose sight of the people aspect of things. And I can be not fun to work with, like just, Why are you standing here? Like, go do your job. Like, go.
Sure.
And so I set parameters because the relationships are the most important thing to me. I've had everything. I've had wealth. I've had fame. I've had marriage. And I've lost everything. And so I think it's not necessarily a fear. It's just an appreciation for the importance of certain things. Like, I value time and relationships more than any material thing. So if it's going to come down to the success of a business but sacrificing a year of time with my spouse, I'm not going to choose it. I'm going to take my time starting up a business or approach it from a different way. I'm not saying I'm going to give up on it, but I'm going to get more creative about how I tackle it. And I think that is long-term preservation of all things important. If you take care of your relationships, then everything else will start to take care of itself too.
Yeah, I think it is important to do that. I mean, my wife and I have been married now, this will be our 18th year.
Wow, that's awesome.
We've been together for 20 years or so. And it's, you know, I was telling her the other day, it's nice because we know each other's moves. So, like, I know how she's going to respond. She knows how I'm going to respond. And sometimes it's not great, but she knows. And there's a lot to be said for that. And that's not something that just gets built overnight, but can be destroyed fairly quick.
Yeah.
And I know that I have that tendency in me to be very task oriented, like you're saying. Also, she called me a robot at times because it's like I'm doing this and then this and then this. Mm-hmm. So, what's next for Taylor Golden, other than the new business that doesn't have a name yet?
Let's see, new business, getting married, hopefully starting a family in the midst of starting a business and everything.
Yeah, because there's
why not.
Why not? That seems like the best time.
Also getting my master's degree and then hopefully my PhD directly after. I'm sure I'll...
What are you getting your master's in?
In business and entrepreneurship.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
I know.
I knew business would be, right? But then entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I think it's a new thing.
And then the PhD?
Same, entrepreneurship and leadership.
With an eye to use it for what?
I feel like, again, this is my gut, and what I feel the stars aligning is that I'm going to have a large platform in the next couple of years. I'm good at public speaking. I'm very empathetic, and I have a story and I have a message. And my passion alongside music is helping people. I love helping people and connecting people to their purpose. So I feel like there's going to be opportunities coming my way. And I don't want not having those degrees or skills or background to be prohibitive from me being able to step into that moment whenever it happens.
So you've identified as that a potential limiter,
mm-hmm.
and said, I'm going to remove that barrier to entry. That's smart.
Yeah.
When do you think you'll be done with your PhD?
Hopefully in the next 5 to 7 years. My goal for my master's is to finish it in 6 months.
How far along are you in it?
I haven't started.
Oh, well. So you're 6 months out.
Yeah, 6 months out.
Yeah. So then you also have Stay Golden. So are you actively working that? I mean, you said you're kind of waiting for everything to sort of align, but you feel like it's moving that direction. You know what's going to happen.
What?
Your new business is going to be going,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going to start your master's.
Mm-hmm.
And then Stay Golden is going to get huge opportunities that you're going to have to pick something.
Maybe. I might.
What would you pick?
I would probably pick Stay Golden. Yeah, because the other business I'm starting has capable business partners,
sure.
that I know that they could step in and support it if I needed to bow out for a bit. But yeah, wherever I can make the most impact in the world is where I'm going to go.
Well, I've said this on another episode, and it was said to me by someone, I can't remember who, but you know, changing the world is actually easier than people think. If you can change the world for a person, mm-hmm. you've changed the entire world.
Yep.
And I think that you're going to do that for multiple people, just whether it's with your book or with Stay Golden or any of those things. I mean, just the company you're talking about now, you know, that's something I hadn't considered when you mentioned, you know, aging population. Mm-hmm. And you know, my next door neighbor, you know, he recently went through some medical stuff. It's been a couple of years now, but he's no longer able. He's not an old man, but mm-hmm. he's no longer able to tend to his yard. So that's an added thing that he needs to be taken off of his plate. And again, you've identified a real need there. Now, the other part that was sad that you identified is that there are capable humans out there that don't know how to mm-hmm. mow a yard.
Yeah.
And that's pathetic to me. But
mm-hmm.
That's great. So if you were looking back on your journey, your entrepreneurship journey from starting your photography business, moving forward, all of that, what is one overriding lesson that you would tell young entrepreneurs?
I would say invest in people. That's like you said, if we can change the world for one person, then you change the whole world. And their whole world just changed. People are the reason why we're here. We're here for human connection, to make the world a better place. Like, what meaning does life have if we don't have a spouse or a child or someone to invest your love and your time and your energy into? And I think approaching business, it's very appealing to get focused on the success side, the fame side, the money side. Let me tell you, all that can be gone like this. Mm. It has for me. And at the end of the day, when all that's gone, what's left are people. And so now what I've shifted my focus from, my company that I work with now has very, very much humbled me. Like, I walked into my position thinking, give me 2 years, I'm going to own this. I'm going to be directing all these people. Like, entrepreneur, here I come. No. I had so much to learn, mostly about servant leadership. And I have a great mentor. And so that's been kind of my mantra the last couple of years, is just, how can I lead but serve at the same time? And so I'm stopped focusing so much on myself and stopped focusing so much on my own goals. And I'm instead focusing on the people underneath me. What are their goals, and how can I help them get to their goals? How can I make them better equipped to solve problems? How can I empower them, make their day better, build character within them? And the more I focus on other people, the more successful I am. And the more just qualities that I get that need to be instilled in me if I do get that moment on a public stage. And so I think if we all just kind of take a step back and realize it's not about us, it's really about people and other people, that it makes sense. It opens up the world of possibilities for you, but also puts things in the right kind of perspective.
You can't go wrong with that. Mm-hmm. That servant leadership, that servant heart is something that tends to only breed success. And even if it doesn't, if someone's not appreciative, you've done your part. You mm-hmm. you have a clear, you know, conscience and heart about it. I think that's exactly right. And it gives you that North Star, like you mentioned, to, man, if you ever feel like you're venturing off or something's just not quite right. And we all know that.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I'm not hitting on all cylinders in my life, and having that to guide you back is critical and important. So I really appreciate everything. Your story is amazing.
Thanks.
And I feel like we really only kind of scratched the surface on it. But, you know, I just want to let you know, I really appreciate you coming on and discussing, you know, kind of your perspective on entrepreneurship and kind of how your journey has been. And you've started multiple businesses. And again, I appreciate you starting one last night just for this.
Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity.
But if you ever need anything, don't hesitate to ask. And where can people find more information out about Taylor Golden?
So you can go to taylorgolden.com. And staygold.en on Instagram.
That domain wasn't taken?
I know,
outstanding.
Right? Like, I will never lose that domain. But yeah, you can stay up to date with me on there.
That's great. And where can they buy the book?
Amazon. You can Google Taylor Golden Divorce, and that'll pop it up. Or it'll link to it from my site.
What a harsh thing to
I
Google.
I know, right?
Good grief, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, outstanding. Well, thank you again. And man, best of luck with everything, new venture, and your current, you know, job that you're in. Seem like you like.
I love it. Yeah.
Awesome.
You.
Well, let's keep in touch.
All right.
And I can't wait to hear the name of the new business.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Taylor.
You're welcome.